Tuesday night edition of the pod, midweek here. I want to talk about a really fascinating game in Milwaukee as they outlasted the Cleveland Cavaliers. Also, a ton of news that's built up that we got to get to. And we'll do a few random questions as well. I haven't done that in a while. Those are always fun to kind of break it up a little bit. And a few notes on Washington, New Orleans, and Sacramento, Philly. Not too much because, you know, we're in danger of running short on all these. So we're really potentially going to run out of material. Why don't we hit some news first here, Mr. LaRue? What we got?
Well, I think we could start with the... So it was always going to be a two-week evaluation period for Curry, and the reevaluation happened... It was announced on Tuesday that Curry will not play for another week, which means he's out for the Christmas Day game against the Cavs. So both teams will be without their ostensible starting point guards.
Yeah, Isaiah Thomas targeting early January for his return. And that's a shame, but it might make the game more interesting. It'll be in Golden State as it was 2 years ago. We may be at that game. We may do the Twitter NBA show. I haven't decided yet. Depends on whether we actually get seats or not. That might be part of it. But takes a little bit of a luster off of that game, but it has at least made Golden State more interesting to me, trying to see them cope without Curry. In other Golden State news, Draymond Green and Zaza Pachulia have both been upgraded to questionable for their tilt tomorrow night against Memphis. And Green has been struggling with this. He played in his homecoming game in Detroit after missing a game in Charlotte, but then has missed the last few now. And Steve Kerr said, you know, it's just, yeah, okay, if it were the playoffs, he could be playing, but we're trying to rest him and get it right. But it has been a little bit of a inscrutable injury. And Pachulia, you'll recall, returned as well against Charlotte, and then he's missed the last few. But because of the preposterous depth on this team, they really have not missed a beat, and they've continued to defend well. And Kevin Durant has proved, I think, again, that he is still in the regular season the same type of MVP caliber player that he was before. And in terms of just carrying a team that doesn't have a bunch of other great offensive players on it. Also, what else we got here?
Well, I think we should go to the Jazz. I mean, because we haven't talked about Rudy Gobert's injury since it happened. Derek Favors fell into him. It didn't look terrible to me, but it definitely did not look good. And it is a PCL and bone bruise for Gobert. He's going to be out. The last thing I remember hearing was about a month, but it could be obviously with something like that, it could be more. And then Favors is out on top of that.
Yeah, for Gobert, the PCL, if you don't know, a more rarely injured ligament that's actually towards the back of the knee. It keeps your knee from hyperextending, and the ubiquitous bone bruise as well. We know that those are difficult to deal with, and Favors missed Monday's game against the Rockets, where the Jazz actually put up a valiant effort and then were just absolutely deluged by Houston three-pointers in the fourth quarter of that game. So they do have Epe Udoh, who can come in. They have Jonas Jerebko, who can play some center as well, and I don't think Favors is going to miss too much time. He may be back for our Thursday Twitter NBA show game. Rodney Hood has returned. He played extremely well against the Rockets last night, scoring over 20 points, and I think he was 5 of 9 from three. So good to see him back. There had been talk that it was a sore ankle, then he said it was a sore Achilles. No, in fact, it was an ankle tendon, and he misspoke in his interview with Tony Jones, but whatever it ended up being, good to see him back on the court. And you know, you're always holding your breath for the next, you know, small injury where he misses 7 or 8 games again with Rodney Hood. All right, lots more news to get to here, but first, this from Tracker. thetracker.com/capspace will get you 20% off any order. And the appeal of the Tracker is you're not going to lose your stuff anymore, your keys, your wallet, because you know that those are the last things that you look for before you're ready to leave. You've got it all planned out. You're going to get there on time. Maybe even you're even a couple minutes late already. And then, oh no, now you can't find your keys. You can't find your wallet. And you're going to spend another 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Well, if you could just eliminate that from your life every single time, why wouldn't you? And you can do it with the all new Tracker Pixel. It's the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. You just place the Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, keys, wallet, purse. It's small enough to fit basically anywhere. And when you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. It also has powerful LED light so you can find it even in the dark. And if you lose your phone, you press the button on your tracker pixel and then your phone rings even if your phone is on silent. So once again, the way to get started with them, go to thetracker.com/capspace. Get your 20% off any order. That slash capspace URL, very easy to remember as we talk about capspace all the time on the program. That's thetracker.com/capspace for 20% off. thetracker.com/capspace. So another thing that I wanted to talk about here with was the Sixers and Marco Fultz. We've mentioned previously that another couple of weeks, 3 weeks for him as he's working back to shooting. I thought Jay King had an interesting piece out of Boston. Surprisingly enough, there's still some interest, of course, in Fultz since they traded away the pick that became him. But he mentioned basically in college, he believes he had a pretty similar injury to Fultz and he just didn't realize what the problem was, but he felt this pain in the front of his shoulder and he ended up shooting in a weird way, much like Fultz ended up doing. They couldn't diagnose it at first as well. And that for Jay, once they actually, you know, had him do some rehab work, the pain went away and he was able to shoot normally again. So I thought that was just an interesting perspective I wanted to share, since it's somewhat contrary to what I have been saying about how, hey, you know, there must be a mental component to this, and perhaps there is, but, you know, Jay at least indicating that if it is a similar injury, perhaps that, you know, all of what we've seen from him could just be physical, and that maybe, you know, they just weren't able to really diagnose it until they came out with that release that it was a scapular imbalance.
And it's a good piece of context too, because this is an injury that so few of us are familiar with, and really we don't have a way of getting bearings on it. You know, that a lot of times with NBA stuff, that happens through other guys. You know, like when somebody sprains their MCL, we have, you know, Jeff Stott's database of how long guys miss with that, but this sort of thing doesn't happen very often. So even if it's anecdotal, it still provides a foundation there. And we got, both of us probably separately and together, got crap for putting Markel Fultz in the top prospects thing, but part of it for me was the idea that, you know, that there was a lot more to look at than just, oh, he couldn't shoot in summer league, that means he's going to be bad forever or anything silly like that. But this, it did give me more comfort on the idea that even though he can provide value in other ways, that he can get back to more of what was so intriguing about him at Washington and before Washington.
In New York, Kristaps Porzingis missed time over the weekend, including their blowout loss to Charlotte on Monday, with what he termed a knee instability after beginning to experience that, I believe, last Friday, and it was deemed precautionary. You recall that he also missed time with that ugly-looking ankle injury, but was able to return after that. And for Porzingis, you know, this is another one of these things, especially lower body injuries, whether it's his hip, his groin, his ankle, his knee, you know, there always seems to be some sort of an issue with him. The good news is that according to BOTP, Berman of the Post, as Frank Isola so endearingly calls him, he is scheduled to return on Thursday, which is good for us because that's when the Tour NBA show is against Boston. And then Tim Hardaway Jr., you'll recall, has missed time with that stress reaction a couple of weeks. There was hope that he could return after that, but it looks like that has been slower to heal than we would have hoped, and he will be reevaluated next week. Speaking of slower to heal than we would have hoped, let's turn to Memphis.
Yeah, I mean, so Conley is still dealing with treatment on his left heel. And to go back a little bit in time, on November 29th, the Grizzlies said that Conley would return in 2 to 3 weeks. So now we're about 3 weeks from that point, and now it will be out at least 2 more weeks. So this is a long time for the Grizzlies. Obviously, that changes things for them, and it's unfortunate because Conley is an absolutely fabulous player. And what compounds on this is just that they have other guys that are dealing with issues too.
A little more on Conley first. They're saying heel, but it's his Achilles, and that's what was said for, and
right.
I think and his Achilles, of course, it's the same Achilles that he experienced soreness in and basically missed the entire second half of the 15-16 season as a result of, but it was fine last year, and now he's experiencing that soreness again. And he had already missed a bunch of time before that November 29th announcement that he would try to return in 2 or 3 weeks. But this is another one of these, I said inscrutable before, but this is like that where, you know, if you just have soreness in a tendon or something, that's a lot of ways you can't predict when someone's going to come back as well with that as you can with, you know, just a meniscus surgery or an MCL or something, because, you know, they don't necessarily know exactly what's causing the soreness. They just have to kind of rehab it, and then, okay, it feels good, now I'm going to ramp up my activity. Okay, do I still feel good? No, got some soreness, got to ramp it back down again. You know, so I think with stress reactions, with these kind of wear and tear type of injuries, that it's much harder to get a timetable there. And then Wayne Selden also is supposed to be back maybe in about about 2 weeks. You'll recall that in typical Memphis fashion, he returned, played 4 minutes, and then instantly had to go back on the shelf again with the same injury. And he's now been out like another month. Chandler Parsons, he missed some time with knee soreness, now also dealing with back soreness. He's been in and out of the lineup, still on a minutes limit, has been effective still when he's played. And then Brandon Wright, someone that they really need for their bench unit, he's expected back sometime this week from his groin injury.
Then another hopeful playoff team in the Western Conference that has been saddled by injuries. The Lou Williams has a left foot sprain, and then he, Gallinari, and Wes Johnson all missed their game against the Spurs.
Yeah, Lou probable to come back against the Suns. Gallo has been ruled out for that game on Wednesday, as has Wes Johnson. So Gallo, there was hope. Dr. Rivers said, hey, you know, he had this fall, maybe he'll be back in a couple of games, looking like it might be a little bit of a longer term thing there. And in Houston, Luke and Mute suffered a shoulder dislocation, but no significant issues per Woj after an MRI, and there's optimism he could return within 2 to 3 weeks, and that happened late last week. But this is something to watch for Houston, because now they're down to having 8 players that Mike D'Antoni trusts and not very many wings. And so even in blowout wins, you know, we saw Trevor Ariza in that game against the Hornets had to play 42 minutes because they really just don't have anyone else that they trust. And for a team that has a couple of different names, number one, they're gonna be fighting hard for home court, they also want to get James Harden his stats for the MVP, but they also ran out of gas last year, in particular Harden, and they're trying to make it to the showdown with San Antonio, the showdown with Golden State, healthy and rested, whereas the Warriors basically, unless it's an overtime game, never play anyone over 36 minutes. And so they have to leave guys in for blowout longer because they're just, their bench is just so bad. And you know, D'Antoni has never been someone to play a lot of guys anyway, so both during the meat of the game and then in blowouts, because they just have basically 5 guys on this team that, you know, can't really play, it's an issue whenever one of their main guys is out, as it will be with Mbamute, although of course Houston continues to roll along nonetheless.
One that I saw last night, and so we talked about a little bit on the show, Brook Lopez went down with an ankle issue. It didn't look great, and it isn't great. It is an ankle sprain, so you say, oh well, it's good it wasn't something more severe, but he's going to be re-evaluated in 3 weeks, so it is not as severe as like the Glenn Robinson one, where he's actually, I think I just heard that he's been cleared to run and jump, but he's still not back yet. But 3 weeks to be reevaluation is a long time for the guy who has been the Lakers starting center this year.
Yeah, and as we talked about yesterday, it'd be very interesting to see whether Luke Walton promotes Bogut or Zubac to go with the traditional center for no reason, just because you're supposed to, or whether he actually goes with some of his best lineup and just gets more of Nance and Kuzma and Randall on the floor. I think if you just go with a 3-man big rotation, also get Ingram some minutes at the four as well, I think that would be more effective for them. Dennis Smith Jr. has now missed 6 straight games. I saw him Thursday warming up. He was going, you know, 50% speed at that point. Went through shoot around on Monday and could return Wednesday versus Detroit. Steven Adams was unable to practice on Tuesday. He is not out of the concussion protocol yet, and I think his absence has been an underrated factor in some of OKC's offensive struggles against 2 pretty porous defense teams, the Knicks and the Nuggets. These last couple of games, they really miss his offensive rebounding, his finishing at the rim, his screening for Paul George, which he's pretty dependent on. So you have to imagine it's going to be a little bit for Adams, who got that concussion late in overtime and then fouled out after that against the Sixers on Friday. The Heat continue to suffer some debilitating injuries. Hassan Whiteside won't travel on their 2-game road trip this week, and James Johnson's going to be out 7 to 10 days with right ankle bursitis.
And that comes on top of Justice Winslow's knee issues, so they're missing a lot of their front court guys. Unfortunately, Miami has a lot of depth, but especially James Johnson, with him and Hassan Whiteside, they don't really have replacements for those guys. They just have talented players who do different things.
Yeah, and Rodney Magruder and Okara White both out with some long-term injuries, and Goran Dragic is dealing with an elbow injury as well, but he's going to try and play Wednesday against the Celtics. We'll see what happens when he goes through shoot-around. Dirk Nowitzki, you remember, he really struggled with injuries at the start of last year. This year, he says, as long as my body feels like it has so far, with no setbacks like last year when I missed 2 months, I'm looking forward to hopefully fulfilling my contract. And he has a $5 million team option for next year, which they could decline and sign him for less, or just keep that team option as well. Another interesting thing that happened recently, Disney, parent company of ESPN, acquired certain assets of Fox Sports, namely their regional sports sports networks, and those happen to have about half of the NBA's local television rights. And so Tom Ziller wrote an interesting piece on what some of the possibilities there are. One of them might be that maybe ESPN will sell a package that'll be better than, sorry, NBA League Pass, which is still just a pretty miserable product in terms of the delays and the lag time. You know, I've got like 150 megabyte per second internet here, and there's still lag, so I'm guessing it's not my problem, and everyone else complains about it as well. So, but that could lead to some interesting stuff. It also kind of takes some competition out of there for local television rights, although presumably those entities will continue to bid for those rights. But, you know, anytime there's some consolidation there, you wonder what's going to happen. It might be good for consumers in terms of having more options and having more of that stuff publicized, but it also could lead to maybe, a streamlining of the production and the cost, shall we say, for some of those broadcasters. What else we got here?
Well, I want to talk about another element of that, and Tom brings this up in the piece, but it's not as accentuated, but I think will be a very important part long-term, is the idea that the networks that are already airing national NBA games lost one of the big competitors for it. Fox, especially FS1, had been one of the teams or one of the entities that was very interested in getting NBA basketball. Well, now they already have it because it's the combination with ESPN. So they will be negotiating in a very different position. And while the NBA chose the same partners that they had before, their bids were informed by other people being invested. And of course, there could be other things like some of the web-based elements and lots of other things in place by the time the television deal comes up. I think that could end up being a major factor, that just having one of the deep-pocketed forces not in play.
In Denver, Emmanuel Mudiay is going to miss time with an ankle sprain that suffered over the weekend. And that's noteworthy because he's had ankle problems in the past. His year in China, he only played like 6 games until before the playoffs because of a bad ankle sprain. His rookie year, he missed a couple of months because of a bad ankle sprain. And so those are always something to watch with him. Denver may, as has been the case basically throughout Moutier's career, be better with him not playing, though. They can just play Will Barton more as a backup point guard. Gary Harris can handle the ball a little bit. Jamal Murray, you know, they've got Jokic to run the offense through. So I don't think they're going to suffer too much. They might even be slightly better, although, you know, obviously he's a guy still that they are trying to develop. They don't have much word on a timetable there yet. And Jabari Parker has been assigned to practice with the Wisconsin Herd, Milwaukee's D-League affiliate this year. So good news for him as he seems to be getting closer. They're still talking about February, but if he's actually going through full contact practices, which it's not clear that he's going to be, but usually that's why you'd assign someone down there. That is a good sign there. And then finally, this will probably be a bad thing in the short term, hopefully a good thing in the long term. Monty McCutcheon, who I believe is the best referee in the NBA, I thought he did an excellent job in the 2016 finals, particularly in Game 7, a game which was not marred by really any bad calls at all, which is pretty tough to do for a game of that intensity. He has worked his final game and will be promoted to a VP position at the league, where he's going to try to help make everyone else better officials. But for super big games, not having him this year, you know, it's going to take a while for whatever reforms he institutes to come in. And I think the league will miss him out there for sure in some of these big games in this year's playoff.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, he isn't necessarily loved in every fan base, but no ref is. And I thought he did a very good job overall. And the league trusted him with so many of big games over the last few years.
Let's get to this Cleveland-Milwaukee game now. It was a 119-116 Buck victory, although quite a bit of yo-yoing in this one. Cleveland surged out to a nice lead early, putting up 34 points in the first quarter. And then the Bucks started the second quarter with a 17-4 run and surged into the lead by halftime.
And what stuck out to me during that stretch was that in the second quarter, which was different in the fourth, and we'll talk about it when it gets there, both teams were playing without their star forwards. LeBron was sitting at the same time Giannis was sitting, and that has been a danger time for the Bucks basically this entire year, but they did a nice job. They hit a couple shots. Brogdon, I think, had 2 threes in that time, and there was one play during it where Wiggins got the ball wide open in the corner twice, passed on the shot the first time, and bricked it the second time. But by and large, they were doing a nice job executing defensively. And that's not the ballyhooed kind of bench heavy lineup that the Cavs have been running, but you kind of thought they would do more. And then that ended up coming into play a little bit in the fourth quarter when, in a slightly different circumstances, the outcome was very, very different.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that huge Cavs run in the fourth, because Milwaukee at one point led by 20 points in the fourth quarter, and Cleveland came all the way back to actually lead by two, and like with 4 minutes left, like they really just totally blitzed them. Cleveland overall, though, giving up a buck 19. This was a return to the bad old days for Cleveland of early in the season. Milwaukee, 27.4% of their possessions were in transition, and off of live rebounds, 47% of their possessions were in transition, and that's just completely unacceptable transition defense from Cleveland. I mean, and they were obviously the Bucks, Giannis, like when they're charged up, Eric Bledsoe can really push the pace as well for this team. I mean, they're difficult to deal with in transition, especially when Giannis gets a rebound in a grab and go. But I mean, they were just blowing it every way you could blow it in transition defense. I mean, there was the, oh, hey, like this guy's got the rebound, so how about two guys just like try to knock the ball away from him after he's already got the rebound, and then once he passes it out, it's a 4-on-3, no matter how long it takes. There was that. There was not communicating in transition, and they still don't have anyone to protect the rim as well, so it was really difficult to deal with Giannis unless LeBron just happens to be in position and happens to be trying on that possession. So they really, really just any time they missed, it seemed like it was going to be a Bucks fast break, and they ran it down their throats, and then they actually ran it down their throats late as well, and that's how they were able to come away with the victory.
Yeah, it was a pretty strange game just in terms of the way that the feel worked, because I mean, when you watch that third quarter especially, and at the end of that you're sitting there going, oh my god, like this is what the good Bucks look like. And while it's true that the lineup that hemorrhaged a lot of the lead was not the same personnel, it was still, in terms of chronology, it was such a quick succession that it was a little bit jarring to me. And so one of the big elements that turned in this was Giannis started the fourth quarter. He was in,
yeah, and then they do that a lot. I mean, yes, like we've been critical. They at least, when they went up 20, kid was like, okay, I can take him out of there, because a lot of times he'll leave him in for like another 6 minutes. He'll play like the first 18 minutes of the second half, but at least they didn't do
right
that this time.
And so Kidd pulled Giannis, and he was only out for 2 minutes and 9 seconds. And in that 2 minutes and 9 seconds, a couple of big things happened. One, Milwaukee was outscored 8-2. So that's, you lose 5 or 6 points off that big lead. But what ended up becoming more critical of that was that they committed 5 fouls in those 2 minutes, and those resulted in 7 free throws, but also put Cleveland in the bonus. So Cleveland then was able to just get a ton of free throws, both in that time, and then once Giannis came back in and LeBron came back in, they were able to get that. And then they were also getting Wade threes and numerous other things. This was a weird game where Wade was gunning for threes and Kyle Korver was missing them. But it's, yeah, an 82
Wade,
game season.
By the way, like people on Twitter were like, oh man, Dwayne Wade is like leading them back. Like he made 1 3-pointer from the corner when he was open early in their run. And I was, because I watched it on delay like you did, and I had seen that tweet. I was like, oh man, he's probably going to like score all these points. And it's like, then he didn't do anything for like 15 more points of the run. And then he hit like 2 threes that were awful contested shots, like to put them up. And so it was just like, well, you know, he happened to make 3 threes, but like, you know, it's not like he was like playing well. This wasn't like throwback Wade or something.
Jeff
like
Green
that
was more active too. I thought, yes, Jeff Green was a bigger part of that run than Wade was. And it's rare to see Jeff Green be the underappreciated Cavs guy, but he was for a portion of it. And also, it was a lineup that, like, with Tristan was out there, Green, Korver, Wade, and Jay Crowder, who actually played the entire fourth quarter. Four of those 5 guys did. And that lineup requires, you know, it doesn't have a ton of great shooting out there. Obviously, Korver's fantastic, but they were able to get stops, and they were really able to push off that. And it's one of the ways, it kind of parallels to a point what Golden State has approached in certain ways with their second unit. And then once they got LeBron in, they were just able to do so much more out there. But I thought one of the mistakes in this game was they pushed back on that run. And yeah, they were playing well. And it was the most ridiculous example of a hot hand for me, because the guy that you're sitting is LeBron freaking James. LeBron only played 3.5 minutes in the fourth quarter. And yes, they did push the lead before he came back in. I think they got all the way back. But there is no conceivable Cleveland lineup without LeBron James that is better than a Cleveland lineup with LeBron James.
Yeah, I mean, and there's definitely, it was interesting to hear the players only broadcast saying, hey, you know what, like, I know it's tough as the coach to leave the guy on the bench, but like, these guys have earned it, like they're doing well. And so, you know, they took a 2-point lead, and then after the Bucks scored a couple times in a row, then they decided they needed to get LeBron in. I mean, and you know, they're famous famous times in NBA history where they've like left stars out of the game. Like, you know, game six of the 92 finals, the Bulls were down 15 at the start of the fourth and they made a comeback with Jordan out of the game. They didn't bring Jordan back until there were, you know, maybe like 4 minutes left or so after they'd basically finished off the lead with the bench unit. But nonetheless, yeah, I think they could have stood to go back to LeBron a little bit earlier. But, you know, I think also there's something to be said for, hey, you know what, we're down 20. We're kind of thinking like, hey, we're not even going to bring him back in the game at all. And now these guys have gotten it back. So, you know, why don't we see if we can rest him a little bit? And you know, LeBron ended up with 34 minutes, which was his least number of minutes in a while. And he was spectacular with 39 points, 6 of 11 on three-pointers. He had that step back to his left, really working. 7 assists, although he did have 7 turnovers. His turnovers have been pretty high in these last couple of games here. For Milwaukee, Eric Bledsoe was spectacular. Only played 32 minutes. And it does really seem like, you know, I guess just because of like the injuries that he has suffered, that, you know, they're trying to keep him around that 32-minute mark. And I think that that's wise. But he had 26 points. He was awesome. 10 out of 16, as we mentioned, just killing the Bucks or killing the Cavs in transition. Dellavedova was back. Interestingly, he started the game next to Bledsoe, despite the fact that Tony Snell was also back. Both of those guys from knee tendonitis. I'm not sure why, if Snell was able to play more minutes than Delly, they wouldn't just start Snell next to Bledsoe and have Delly come off the bench. But then they also had Malcolm Brogdon come off the bench, and he was instrumental in that second quarter run. Finished with 16 points. Chris Middleton had 17 points and 10 assists, actually, or 18 points and 10 assists for the game, 17 in the first half, and then was really shut down and had 5 turnovers as well in the game. He had one of the more maddening plays that I can recall, where he gets the rebound with the Bucks up two, and there's, you know, maybe about a 10-second differential, shot clock to game clock at the end, and dribbles across half court. Eric Bledsoe, the point guard, comes over to get the ball, and Middleton just waves him away, just holds the ball for the entire possession, and goes into an ISO against Dwayne Wade, gets stopped, gets stripped, throws a no-chance pass that gets knocked away and deflected, and then Giannis just out-hustled LeBron to the ball and was able to get the and-one layup to clinch it. But it was just like, all right, Eric Bledsoe is a better player than you, Chris. Giannis is a better player than you, Chris. You got 1 point in the second half. You don't have like some unbelievable matchup. You didn't even run any kind of play. You wave the guy away when your point guard goes to get the ball. Like, you do not wave him away. Like, that's your point guard. You're supposed to like give him the ball and let him run a play. It was really just a very, very annoying play. And it didn't seem like anyone was annoyed with him, but I was just like, especially because to me, and he had a couple of other just like annoying ISOs too late in the game, where it was just like that you have all these other non-shooters on the floor and they're all standing on the weak side, and then he just tries to like back down and of course goes right into a double team because they don't have any spacing. It's just like, if he would just space out more and the coaching staff could get him to do that instead of just like, all right, you know, trying to ISO as much as he does, I think they could just be so much better offensively. And obviously, I mean, you wanted to talk more about that run that the Cavs had. I mean, the offense during that run was really just miserable.
It was. I mean, they took just a slew of rough shots. Some of them were just, they never got anything good. You know, like you have an entire 18 seconds, it wasn't usually the full 24, where you don't really create any separation. So a guy's just taking a contested 20 to 25 footer. And that was what fueled Cleveland's run. I mean, they don't have a ton of guys in some of those lineups that can really generate it. But you look at it and you go, okay, how is that group going to beat us? And the answer is by us not being able to score. And you've talked about this a lot, about the idea that runs like this happen from defense, but so that can be defense fueled by the other team's bad offense too. And it was both. Okay, Cavs deserve a lot of credit, but it was both of those things together.
Yeah, so the end of the game was really interesting. It's a 1-point game. Cavs lead. Korver got a nice wide open 3-pointer that he just was in and out. It really looked like it was going to be down. Actually, no, I'm sorry. That was the later one. But he got a couple of 3-point looks in the last minute. Giannis gets the rebound. And this is the play where it was like, oh yeah, two Cavaliers. Let's just go try and strip him of the defensive rebound instead of running back on defense. So then he outlets it to Bledsoe. Great push by Bledsoe. And then he turned around right behind him and Tony Snell is wide open for a 3-pointer. But it was all because two guys decided, oh yeah, let's try and like knock it away from Giannis. Let's go for this lazy, you know, hey, we look like we're really trying hard, but in reality, you're just, you know, excusing yourself from getting back on defense for this 2% chance that you're going to knock the ball out of Giannis' hand, and they give up a transition three, which was really the key play. And then the Cavs got a timeout after that, and Lou went to one of his favorite plays, and the Bucks were absolutely ready for it. They did a great job. They had, it was Wade handling the ball. They love to have either JR or Kyle Korver start on the block and set a back screen for LeBron, and that's usually LeBron can get a backdoor play. He could also just post up out of that as well, like duck in, or, you know, he can go up for the alley-oop, because the guy guarding Korver is usually a small guy who doesn't want to leave Korver as well. So either LeBron has the size advantage on that guy if you switch it, or Korver can be open as well after he sets the back screen. But the Bucks were all over that. And the biggest part, which you always forget about too, with the, especially with all these great passing teams, is ball pressure is so important, because LeBron was open and the players were like, hey, when they're doing like LeBron's open, like they missed him. Well, the reason they missed him was because there was great ball pressure, I think by Tony Snell, on Dwayne Wade. And that's Wade kind of had to get a little more defensive with the ball and just wasn't able to make that split second decision for the pass due to the ball pressure. And then LeBron missed a tough three-pointer against Giannis with a step back. They got the rebound, and then there's, you know, that Middleton play that I was complaining about. And then at the end, yeah.
Well, so then that was when Korver, wasn't that when Korver had that in and out three? I thought that was right off the LeBron miss. Am I right about that?
Oh, yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, that is, I did miss that in the sequence, but yeah, it was, they at least forced, like they had to run the time down, and that James missed three was like right at the buzzer, and Wade just happened to get the rebound. And that's when they got lucky that Korver missed that three, which could have put Cleveland up. But then at the very end, they are, LeBron does this ridiculous play. They're down five after Giannis gets the end one. He throws it off the back of Giannis, who's trying to deny the ball in bounds, picks it up, goes to his left, hits an impossible three-pointer to put them within two, but there's only 1.4 left at that point. So Middleton gets fouled, makes the first one, they're up three, and Jason Kidd then instructs him to miss the second one on purpose, when if he just makes the shot, you're up by four. It was totally insane, and Kidd was asked about it after the game. He's like, well, you know, I didn't want them to be able to get a four-point play, and you know, the Cavs did have no timeouts left, so all right, the idea is, hey, we miss it, and then, you know, they're, once you get the rebound, they're not even going to be able to get it off. You know, if he makes the shot, then you can inbound it all the way down. But, you know, at that point, you could just have everyone like lay down on the court and like not commit a foul. And by having him intentionally miss it, we've seen this before. Usually when teams are down, they try to intentionally miss, but NBA players aren't good at intentionally missing. We've seen guys just like airball it or only hit the backboard, and that's a violation. So by having him intentionally miss it, the only thing that could go wrong, the only time way that you could get a situation where they can inbound the ball and actually have a realistic chance of tying the game. I mean, there's still, you know, 1.4 seconds. They got to go the length of the court, but you know, it's realistic-er, I guess. It's still, you know, we're talking on the margins here, but you know, if he intentionally misses, he could very easily commit a violation, and then you can actually give them a minimal but still a chance to tie the game. And so, like, this is the second time really that Kidd has been too cute by half, where he's just like, oh yeah, like I think they're gonna do this, so hey, here's some like little cute advantage that I have, you know. And he did that kind of stuff like as a player too, where he'd just like run into whatever coach it was. I think it was Mike Woodson, who was just on the floor and like got a technical foul because the guy was on the floor. And then the early days when he had Tyshawn Taylor run into him with the coke to try to get an extra timeout and ended up getting fined for it. But it's just like, it's pretty easy. Either you make the free throw and you're up four and the game's over, or you miss the free throw and at least you know that you're going to hit the rim because you were trying to make the free throw with a 90% free throw shooter. He's not going to airball it. Just like, I don't want to spend that much time on something that didn't really matter ultimately, but it's very indicative of just kind of like Jason Kidd. Just, he tries to like outsmart everyone and enjoy himself because he's outsmarting everyone, but in reality, he's not really outsmarting everyone.
Yeah. I was struck by it in the same way that you were, and I don't want to dwell on it either. But
this isn't as bad as the intentional foul up by four.
No.
But yeah.
But it's not great. And the other thing I wanted to mention about this, you talked about Eric Bledsoe's game, was you noticed how beneficial it was for the Bucks to have a second creator, especially somebody who has athleticism and the other things that Bledsoe brings alongside Giannis, because there were plays where the Cavs were just trying to basically get Giannis out of the play, and they would have stalled out. Even, I mean, Brogdon, yeah, he won Rookie of the Year last year and all that kind of stuff, but Bledsoe is just a whole different animal as a point guard and brings an element to them that I really like. That said, as valuable as he is in those minutes, he's also valuable in the minutes Giannis doesn't play, so that's just something they have to reconcile. But I think the Bledsoe-Giannis combination was really helping them out.
Yeah, it is. Although I do think maybe, especially because now they've got all their guys back and they can get more shooting on the floor. I mean, it was still troubling to me that DeAndre Liggins played 16 minutes because, I mean, he has zero chance ever making a shot. I mean, he was taking him and it's not close for him. Looks ugly. Like how he once shot 38% on three-pointers and isn't in the G League, I just have no idea. But, you know, whatever he once used to be as a shooter, he's now not that anymore. And obviously he was well-known as a non-shooter coming out of school. But yeah, I think that some lineups going to Bledsoe in spread pick and roll, like that would be a good theory of the lineup, as we so often talk about with bench units, and much better than just, hey, let's have Chris Middleton go to work ISOing, because that's usually like where they get their offense, both Bledsoe and Giannis, out of the game in some of these bench units. We'll talk a little bit about these other games today, and also maybe do a question or two after this from Stamps.com. Danny, you have been a loyal Stamps.com customer of late with all this mailing you've had to do for the book.
I have, and it's a sometimes it's a lot of packaging of similar proportions, which it's nice because you could just rapid fire go through it, change the address and things like that. But just the overall convenience of being able to handle so much of that from home, being able to have pickups at home it's a godsend. And especially for people like us who have kind of unusual jobs, it's in many ways even more valuable, just because whatever your style of life is, you can make Stamps.com work well for you.
Yeah, they bring all of the services of the U.S. Post Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. Then the mailman picks it up. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale, which automatically calculates exact postage, and they'll help you decide the best class of mail every time, any day, anytime. Stamps.com is always open, nice for us night owls, to be sure. Right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to stamps.com, click on that microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in, you all know what it's going to be, Capspace, that familiar code, since we talk about Capspace all the time in the program. That's stamps.com, promo code Capspace. So just had a few observations on the Sacramento Philly game. Sixers now losing on back-to-back nights to two of the worst teams in the league, although maybe you can't say that about the Bulls, having won six straight with the triumphant return of Nikola Mirotic, but 101-95. And most striking about this was the Sixers really struggled to score, and JJ Redick exited the game with hamstring tightness early in the third quarter. He was plus 13, and after that, I mean, really there's one semi-reliable shooter on this team, and that's Covington, and he was unreliable today, going 2 of 13 from downtown. The Sixers certainly took plenty of threes, and Jared Bayless actually did go 4 of 8, but he has a lot of other limitations when he's closing the game for you. That's not too good. And Ben Simmons had a troubling game, despite nearing a triple-double with 13 points, 12 rebounds, and 9 assists. Only 5 of 6 from the field, and we really saw that without Embiid, without the spacing to go to work, they were able to just pack the paint, especially when they had Willie Cauley-Stein in. He really was not able to get to the rim, and he also just wasn't being aggressive enough as well. I mean, there were a couple of times, like one where he just got a pass under the rim and could have just gone up for the dunk. It would have been a little bit contested, but he's 6'10". I think he had the size advantage on whoever was down there, and he just passes it out for a three-pointer, and it's games like this, despite the fact that he was an efficient 5 out of 6, that make me a little bit lower on his ceiling than you, because it's just, you know, they needed him to score more, and it did not seem like he necessarily was capable of doing that in this one against a Kings defense that is not good.
And a Kings defense that in the fourth quarter was playing really small. I mean, Sacramento was playing with one center, and it's not like, oh, they were playing fours. They were playing Vince Carter a lot at power forward. They were playing Malachi Richardson had a significant amount of time there. Buddy Hield was, of course, out there. And then Garrett Temple started the game but scored all 9 of his points in the fourth quarter. So they're playing basically all those guys together. And so while Simmons is not like a post guy or anything like that, he has physical advantages there that you need to capitalize on. And Indiana, to some basic stats in that fourth quarter, they had as many turnovers, 5, as they had made baskets, also 5.
Yeah,
and
Philly, you mean? I think he's
Philly, yeah. Philly. Episode. Yeah, I don't know why. And they were 5 of 20 from the field, 3 of 10 from 3. And the 3 of 10 from 3 isn't a huge surprise if Covington's not going to make a ton of them. He was 1 for 5 during that stretch. And they they were just, they couldn't get a real offensive identity out there. And since Sacco was going small and they were getting stops, they were able to get looks in transition, and they also had enough spacing that they were able to get things too.
Yeah, the Kings, despite 7 of 27 three-point shooting, were able to outlast the Sixers in this one. I thought it was interesting, you know, De'Aaron Fox started the game at point guard. He had been dealing with quad soreness and then only played 11 minutes. He appeared to maybe re-injure the quad as he was fouled by Simmons. He looked like he got kneed in the thigh. I'm not sure if that was the same injury or something else. And also just, you know, wasn't playing well at the beginning. And so, you know, they went with Frank Mason, who just really continues to play well. 16 points on 7 of 9 from the field, plus 12 in this one. But as you mentioned, they closed it with, you know, Garrett Temple basically playing point guard. They had Malachi Richardson out there, of all people. Bogdanovich did not play well either. He's returning from injury as well. He only played 18 minutes in this one. So Jaeger went to his bench. And then really the only starter who was in at the end, other than Temple, was Zach Randolph. And he had 27 points in this one. He's had a couple of throwback games recently. And he was able to beast inside because the Sixers were so desperate for offense. They actually were playing Šarić at center with Simmons at power forward and trying to just get some more shooting out there. They also have McConnell out there and still were unable to score. And so, I mean, this Sixers offense, I mean, especially without Redick out there, without Embiid, like, they're going to look bad. And it's interesting to think of Philly now, 14 and 16, about equal schedule between home and road. But you would have to say, I mean, I know Embiid has missed a couple of games here. And also noteworthy that, you know, he was supposedly missed the Chicago game due to maintenance, but then couldn't play in this one either due to this back tightness. He had the back tightness before that game on Friday and then played 49 minutes. And lo and behold, oh, he's not able to play the next two games, right? So maybe, I know you're trying to win an overtime game and you get caught up in things, but maybe they needed to just be a little bit more judicious about that. You know, they're 14 and 16 right now, and I mean, they've probably had about as good a health as you could have hoped, right? Like, Simmons has played every game. Embiid has probably played more games than we would have guessed at the start of the year. He's played better than we would have guessed at the start of the year. They haven't had any other real significant injuries. I mean, Fultz maybe, but he was not supposed to be a positive player for them this year anyway. And still, you know, they're 14 and 16, and despite all the hype here, they could get into a little bit of trouble in this East playoff race if they're not able to turn it around. And they are now 1-6 this season when Joel does not play.
Yeah, that was something that has been, and a lot of those losses have been to teams in the bottom half, even the bottom 10 of the league. So it is notable, you know, when you lose to the Kings, and the Bulls is a little bit different because they've been 6-0 since Mirotić got there. But I want to keep an eye on them. And if we do the random questions, one of the things that I'm thinking about is the playoff picture. And in the East right now, it looks like it's 10 teams for 8 spots because Charlotte and Orlando have just really fallen off pace.
Let's just talk about that right now, actually.
Okay.
I don't need to get into this Washington-New Orleans game that badly. It was a weird game. The Wizards went up by 20, and then New Orleans went on a 24-1 run to come back and take a 1-point lead, after which Washington went on their own 24-5 run, and then just, you know, it was a blow up. But by that point, it was a really odd game in which New Orleans, aside from that 24-1 run, was just utterly outplayed. But yeah, let's talk about that East playoff picture right now. What did you want to discuss there?
So there are different levels to this, but as I'm looking at it at the moment, if we want to say that Charlotte and Orlando, due to injuries and effectiveness and just everything else like that, they're not out. They're just unlikely, I would say, at this point. If you take those two teams out, then it's, in all likelihood, it's 10 teams for 8 spots. And so I would say three of those are basically locked in: Boston, Toronto, and Cleveland. Those teams are excellent. Those teams have played well. They've got a pretty significant lead on the field. Then how you differentiate the next group is there, but it's Washington, Milwaukee, Detroit, Indiana, Miami, Philly, and the Knicks. And two of those teams won't make it. And sometimes when you have 10 for 8 or something like that, where you have two excess teams, injuries will play a major factor in it. But also, I mean, we have to, like, one of these teams might just fall out because they're ineffective or worse than the other ones. And so I was kind of wondering how you're feeling about that collection of teams, more so than the three at the top that we feel are all good.
Yeah, I mean, for 538 right now, Heat projected as the 8th seed, 64% chance of making the playoffs. I mean, they're dealing with their own injury issues. The Sixers now at 14 and 16, projected for 39 and 43, 45% chance of making the playoffs. Knicks 35%. Hornets still given a 27% chance because their fundamentals are not so bad, and they had that blowout win against the Knicks, which probably helped them a little bit, both in the numbers and in the standings. And the Pacers, we keep waiting for them to fall apart as well. I mean, I do think that the Bucks, clearly to me, have by far the most talent of any of those teams, you know, outside of the Wizards, you know, and I think the Wizards, to me, just have been doing it for longer, and they don't have the coaching issues that the Bucks have. So, and the Bucks still have to reintegrate Parker, which could be interesting. So we'll see whether, like, the Wizards or Bucks are more likely to take that fourth seed. I think it'll probably be the Wizards. But I like the Bucks the most out of those kind of bottom four teams. And I'm just, I think the Sixers are going to be the ones out of it. And, you know, the Knicks are above 500 right now. But as we talked about, you know, if they're still at 500 or close to it after, like, their home and road schedule evens out, you know, then I'll start to take them seriously. I'm not quite there yet.
Right. Yeah. I'm kind of thinking one team goes on an effectiveness, that being the Knicks is the most likely team, and then the other one could be injuries. So I would say my expectation, and the Sixers have a lot of tough games coming up. They have two against Toronto, and we don't know when Embiid's coming back. Those are their next two games. But then in January, they just play a lot of good teams. They have Boston twice, the Spurs twice, OKC, Milwaukee twice. So, like, and they don't have much padding there. And so with a young team that still has a lot to figure out, you know, the Sixers can beat almost anybody. Like, they're good enough to do that, but they have to be full strength and they have to be engaged. And so I think they're the most likely of those teams to fall out, but I will pencil in that spot for just somebody getting bad luck. And you never want it to be anybody, but it's always somebody.
Yeah, and I think the Sixers, they've already made this trade. They have this plethora still of surplus second round picks. If they could find someone who would be an upgrade on Bayless and TLC, that combination right now, and also McConnell, well, he has played well. We mentioned how it's really tough with a fit with him when Simmons is out there, and so he probably shouldn't be playing really more than 15 minutes a game or so. If they can find someone who can really be an upgrade there, and, you know, I doubt that's going to be Fultz, and who knows when he's going to be back anyway, but he's going to play a little bit too. But they got to get more shooting now with Redick. You know, I think they've been leaning on him a little bit too much. He got this hamstring tightness. He's had some issues so far. And so this is kind of why, you know, I didn't really appreciate the Trevor Booker trade, because I felt like it was a misidentification of what they needed. They got plenty of bigs, even with Embiid out. I mean, it was telling that they got all these bigs and they didn't play any of them down the stretch because they just couldn't score and they were trying to score. So getting some more shooting on the floor. TLC has really been struggling. He was a further one of five tonight. Did hit a three, but he had this corner three that he was so wide open and you could just see he was kind of aiming it, like not shooting an easy ball. And it seems like his struggles are starting to get into his head a little bit. And then Bayless, it just provides too many weaknesses defensively, even if he can hit a shot. So I think if they can upgrade there, maybe I'll feel better about them. And then, of course, it all depends on Embiid's health as well.
Yeah, I mean, the 1-6 without him in the lineup, you can tell how large he looms in. Also, Dario Saric has been a little bit shakier from three. I think he's at about 32% in December when he's at 34 for the season. And while you look at the whole sample, when something ties in more with what you expected from him and what his past track record is, kind of go, okay, well, if he's that guy, more that guy than who he was at the start of the year, it doesn't necessarily make their starting lineup look different because they just don't have that many other options. But you think about his long-term role in it. I mean, now with Covington, Simmons, and Embiid looking locked in as three key pieces of this, then you, like, the Colangelo can look at this overall picture in terms of who makes sense with those guys. And there are kind of lottery ticket type players that they can try. And I don't think they should necessarily use their best assets on that. And then also, I believe they still have the room exception, which they could potentially throw some money at if the right person, either through a buyout or whatever circumstance, just gets on the market, to just try to find an answer. And that would be nice to use because it doesn't require any assets and it's not like they're anywhere close to the tax. So it could be a good little asset for them to use, a tool for them to use moving forward.
Yeah, it would have to be someone obviously on the free agent market, although there are a lot of teams that have some firepower there. Let's do the same analysis in the West here. They're really...
Well, that was going to be my random question, so we can tie this in. My question was going to be, how many wins do you think the 8th seed ends up with in the West?
Well, as of now, the Blazers are projected to be the 8th seed, and they are projected to have 42 wins. Now, the Pels are projected to finish one game behind the Blazers. They're number 9, but then you go down to the Clippers with 35 wins. So, you know, I think probably 41 41 would be right about it, 41, 42. But we'll see. I mean, the Jazz have continued to play okay without Gobert. They have a lot of depth other than him. The Thunder have clawed back to 500, but they're not really playing any better. And in some ways, they're actually playing worse than they were beforehand. I think their point differential, as they were at 1.8 and 12, and now have clawed back to 500, making them 7 and 3 over their last few. They actually have gotten extremely lucky in close game over these last few, and have kind of been playing worse. The defense has slipped a little bit, and the offense is no better. By the way, David Locke had he checked out some film of that game against Denver. He said that Russell Westbrook had, I think, 17 touches in the last 9 minutes of the game and passed 3 times, and that Paul George had like, and this is off the top of my head, so forgive me if I'm getting this a little bit wrong, but the gist of it is certainly correct. Paul George had like 1 touch in the last 9 minutes of the game.
Well, I mean, remember that game, I think that was the last time they played Denver, when Paul George, the only time he touched the ball in the last 5 minutes was when he stole the ball himself.
Yeah, and Russ willed them to that win. I mean, he had 38 points. The rest of the guys weren't scoring. And I mean, they won the game, but Locke makes a great point, which is, do you really, especially if you're a guy who has talent, do you want to play with Russell Westbrook? Now, in Westbrook's defense, he tried the like super passive route earlier. Now, of course, the problem with the super passive route is it's exactly that. It's super passive, right? Like, he just passes the ball and it's like, okay, now you go do something, as opposed to, all right, I'm going to be an active cutter. I'm going to be an active screener. You've documented his utter lack of screen assists. It's basically, anytime he passes the ball, it's just go stand somewhere else, put your hands on your knees. There's no real, and then maybe he'll run in and try and get an offensive rebound, because those count in the stat sheet. But it's definitely difficult to play with him. I think and that maybe, obviously KD didn't want to be there anymore, but maybe we don't give KD enough credit for how he was able to be as effective as he was playing with Westbrook. And then also they have some issues in terms of Adams being out and the lack of depth. I mean, that's another problem. And it's also Carmelo and George not hitting the shots that they are able to get. So, I mean, I understand from Westbrook's perspective of like, hey, I tried to give to these guys. We lost. Like, these guys were playing terrible. Like, I was scoring well. Like, I'm going to go take over. I'm going to go 1,000 miles an hour. But, it's still not a recipe for staying south by any.
I agree with all that. But let's move on to just thinking about the West playoff picture. There are some strong parallels with the East, being that there are three teams that are probably ahead of everyone else: the Warriors, the Rockets, and the Spurs. All those teams are 10 plus, in many cases, a lot more than that, over 500. The Spurs are 21-10, but they're going to be better as Kawhi improves. I mean, they've had just an impressive start.
He's continued
to
not look great, though. He was
yeah, he has.
On Monday.
It's going to take some time. And then after that, you have this group of teams that both of us feel are more talented than some of the other ones, but nobody's really separated themselves. Minnesota is 18-13 now, so they've separated a little bit, but I'm still not completely sold on them all the way. But that margin might end up being significant. And then you have Denver, OKC, Utah, Portland, and New Orleans, all of those teams. So that theoretically would be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. All of those teams are within 3 games of 500 in one direction or the other. And they're all dealing with injuries in various capacities. I mean, the Pelicans, it's more of like the season-long Solomon Hill variety. Denver's getting some of their guys back. And so how are you feeling about that? And then I'll give my thoughts.
Well, the Pels were kind of a trendy pick to get back into it. And then Rajon Rondo came back. And Rondo, -6.2 net rating. And in particular, the defense has completely fallen apart whenever he's out there. 115.9 defensive rating, which is, 4 points worse than the worst defense in the league when he's been out there. And especially when you throw him in together with Cousins, and you've got a pretty flammable defensive combo there in terms of their effort. So, and Rondo has had like enough nice games where he's looked really good, where it's sort of like you can get past that. But, I still think that they are better not playing him. And, they're going to a lot of lineups now with Rondo and Holiday and Etwan Moore at the three. And those are some nice offensive lineups, but you're really going to struggle to stop anybody on the perimeter with that group. And, they have Jameer Nelson, who I think is a totally fine backup point guard. I'm just thinking that, as long as they're playing Rondo this much, they're not going to stop anybody. And it's not all his fault, but
no, it's not.
A lot of it's Cousins too.
You want a stat on that?
Oh, desperately.
So there have been 5 games since Rondo got back, but Anthony Davis didn't play. So it's only a 4-game sample that we're dealing with, if just kind of since the I'll deal with that, and then I'll probably try to pull it from the time before. Davis and Rondo have played about 21 minutes a game together, and their defensive rating is 116 in those minutes. Then Davis is playing about 18 minutes a game because he's playing 39 averaging 39 these, defensive rating of 100.3. So there's a difference of 16 in that. Again, it's a small sample, but it is notable in that way.
Yeah, and that's their starters too. So Cousins is probably out there for a lot of that time that Davis and Rondo are there together as well. And Rondo played a little bit less in this one against the Wizards. But so if I had to guess, I mean, but it's just, you know, it's tough, right? I mean, the Thunder had the most talent, but they have these fit issues. Their offense has been horrible. The Nuggets, Jokic is like kind of back now, but Millsap is still out. I trust them to score. I don't trust them to defend. The Wolves have done well in the clutch, but they can't stop anybody either. I mean, all of these teams have massive holes. The Jazz have big injury concerns. The Blazers' offense is rough because they can't shoot. I mean, these are all just some very flawed teams, and it really seems like just whoever's going to get lucky in close games or whoever gets the most hurt is the one that's going to fall out of it. But if I had to pick one, just because it's always seems to be the Pels, they just seem to be like the worst luck team of any of these, and I don't really trust them organizationally or coaching to overcome that. You know, if you want to say Jazz, Blazers, Pelicans, I trust Terry Stotts and Quinn Snyder to find a way with limited personnel more than I do the Pelicans, and especially just
one also
not a believer in Cousins and Rondo winning players.
The other big component of that is that New Orleans is very dependent on Anthony Davis, and Anthony Davis is injury prone.
Right.
It doesn't always have to be big stuff, but they need him out there. And
they
not...
have no depth, right? I mean, the Jazz, and at least CJ and Dame never get hurt, boys.
So I got the longer stats. So Rondo's, the first game where he played significant, he played 25 minutes against Denver on 11-17. The splits since that point, defensive rating, Rondo plus Davis, 109.6. Defensive rating, Davis minus Rondo, 94.2.
All right, that's a good one to end on here. Dill Murphy's going to be on tomorrow. Looking forward to having him on, and we'll talk a little bit more about the Thunder, get into some more, of course, of his coaching analysis. He did a nice piece on like how ice coverage works, which is very interesting, the theory behind that. We're going to get into that a lot as well. And that will do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you all next time. Till then.